Welcome to Dr. Hustle, the podcast where we interview physicians and health professionals who are living at the crossroads of innovation as leaders, entrepreneurs, and artists. Our mission is to showcase the insights and skills that can help you discover the creative and leadership potential within yourself. Here's your host, Bassam Zahid.
Hey listeners, welcome to episode one. I have a question for you. How often have you said to someone, I need to travel more? Or how about, if I can just get through these next 2 weeks, I'll have more time? And then, do you actually travel? Do you actually find more time? I know I'm guilty of both, and I never actually end up traveling, and I never find more time. And instead, I give myself an excuse that the moment isn't right. In other words, like all physicians, I'm an expert in delayed gratification. Except, the delay is perpetual, and the gratification never comes. My next guest, however, has mastered the art of spontaneity. Dr. Calvin Sun is an emergency medicine physician who is the president and CEO of the Monsoon Diaries, an international travel company that has led travel groups in dozens of countries. In just 8 years, this is during medical school and residency, when none of us had any time, Dr. Sun traveled to over 150 countries, including North Korea, Iran, Antarctica, Pakistan, Venezuela, and Cuba. In addition to giving a TEDx talk called Take the Path of More Resistance, he has cultivated a variety of interests from filmmaking to dancing to being a DJ, and he's been invited to speak at over 200 high schools, colleges, and conferences. He's a remarkable person who will help you realize that you just might have more time than you think.
So Dr. Sun, welcome to the podcast. Thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
So you've had a lot of experience, probably a decade of traveling.
It's about, I would say, 7 to 8 years now. So not, haven't hit that point yet.
Were you always a big traveler? Like
no,
even before
then? No, absolutely not. I started off as a New Yorker, a New York egocentric, center of the universe kind of New Yorker where the whole world comes to me. So I never felt the need to travel when I was growing up here because I felt, you know, the world comes to New York. So what's the point of spending hundreds, thousands of dollars to go see places that you're not going to live in anyway, because New York is the greatest city on the planet. That was me growing up and very immature and closed-minded. And I never really came around to considering traveling as a lifestyle or something that was valuable until I was 23. And that's when I was dragged kicking and screaming into travel. It took me 3 weeks to finally enjoy it.
But you have like pretty eclectic hobbies, right? You've done DJing, you've done breakdancing.
Yes.
That was also part of your childhood, right? Like you learned those things growing up.
I think part of it was a product of rebelliousness, a rebellion against my parents who tried to keep me in a very sheltered bubble. And as a result of me feeling frustrated, especially if you grow up in a city like New York, you're exposed to all these possibilities, but you're prevented from doing so. That desire to do different things was always there. It wasn't until some family tragedy and a few traumatic episodes of my life growing up, and which you can get into, where I finally just took the effort and time to break out of my shell and take the risks of doing different things. And also just being from New York, born and raised there, I get bored really easily. So that was, I guess, always been part of my DNA of being curious of doing different things because, you know, if you're never going to do it now, when are you going to do it ever?
So, yeah, I mean, I just find that a pretty interesting dichotomy because sometimes you, in your life, you feel like you have been closed, but then other times you're like really open. And you're kind of walking that line for a while.
I think that dichotomy plays into your personality. At least for myself, I felt that there's a part of me that's very introverted and shy and actually nervous in social situations. And I make up for it, at least over time. I learn to make up for it by putting myself out there that has now become part of me that I'm more comfortable, if you will, being an extroverted introvert or introverted extrovert. It's like 50-50 for me now, where before it was much more introverted. There's still parts of me that I feel like there is a dichotomy that's struggling with what each other. Should I like, you know, should I go out or should I stay in? Should I like put myself out there? Should I just hang out with people that I know in a certain situation? These things are always there, but the true core of me, I think I'm always self-aware, and I try to stay true to that. Whatever feels right in the moment. I think we're all very complex individuals. I think a lot of people can relate to how nobody's really black and white and just one thing, but just many different shades where they, depending on the situation, the context, and their mood, can take on different behaviors and intentions.
It's interesting to hear you say that, because you all have this idea, this philosophy that you say on your website, monsoondiaries.com, where you talk about a lot of times people make excuses for travel. Right? You say, you know, it's, people will be like, it's not the right time. It's too expensive. It doesn't make sense. You also have this idea of, you know, go hard or go home.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's, I'm finding it interesting to hear you talk about that. Sometimes you do have these battles where you're like, I don't really want to go out.
Yeah. It's a self-awareness that one has to come to terms with. What are your habits? Right? I think the big question that defines somebody really, and then we talk about, you're not black and white, you're all this complexities, you're like this dichotomy and different shades and yada yada yada, but ultimately what defines you as a person that is consistent are your habits. Your habits define you. When you are confronted with variable X, how do you respond? What is your habit? And I think it's important to develop a habit of constant self-awareness. And if you're self-aware enough to realize, the next level is that you give excuses to challenging situations or opportunities, such as travel. And then that is your habit. You do that over and over and over and over again. That becomes who you are. And unless you're self-aware, you can go by your entire life without realizing that you've been postponing the things that you're meant to do until it's too late. And what I've been trying to do for myself when I was growing up is to be aware of my habits, to realize that I grew up refusing to travel because of some habit of believing that New York was the center of the universe and I didn't need to ever in my life. And then until the age of 23, when something big happened, I tried to redo and unlearn everything that I ever learned, break down everything I ever believed in, and restart my habits again. So every time that I am presented a unique opportunity that seems challenging, my habit is more just do it. Nike. You know, just do it. But throwing myself all the way, because at the end of the day, I realize I rather regret more the things I haven't done than the things I have done. But that requires constant self-awareness, because as we just talked about like a couple minutes ago, I'm still this shy, introverted kid deep down that is actually more afraid of doing things, because that's the world I grew up in and was raised in the household I was in. So that's always there. And it's always that, again, that dichotomy of struggle back and forth, this wrestling between two different worlds.
And you just mentioned that you had something big happen to you at 23. So if you don't mind, do you want to talk about that?
Sure. I guess very briefly, a lot of people who travel with me know the story, so they can like fast forward. But essentially, I was 23 years old. I was bartending, and it was at a time where I didn't think about anything related to traveling. I thought it was something that other people did and not me, because from New York. And then I met a couple of friends were all going to Egypt at the same time. It was kind of that like coincidental people getting together. And then they all tried to encourage me to come to Egypt with them. And it was just a kind of like a one day thing. Like one minute I didn't expect it to happen. And next minute I found out four of my friends were going to Egypt at the same time. And then they kept asking me to come. And then later that night, I tried to push it back. And I made a joke where I said, tickets are under $700. Just to push them away, and just because I knew the tickets were like 3,000 at the time, or right, 2,000, because they were leaving the next day. And I did kind of check. So we go out, they take my phone and they reload the websites, and it's still like 2,000, 3,000. I'm like, hey, look, it's not going to go down, but you know, you all have fun in Egypt and I'll just see you when you get back. And then like last call, 4 o'clock in the morning, we get up, we leave, and then they press reload one more time. And it's 2,000. They press reload one more time and it's $650.
Whoa.
And I was like, I'm a man of my word. And I did shake on it, and it was a great deal. I was bartending at the time, so it was easy for me just to call in and say, this is a great deal. I mean, 4 o'clock in the morning. We bought on the spot.
That's amazing.
That autofill thing where you put like write out your first name and it fills out the rest, the credit card info. Like they did that for me, and I woke up the next morning thinking it was all a dream. And they actually left a bunch of text messages, voicemails, like, we'll see you in Egypt. Don't worry, you'll just buy all your things there. When you get there, it's cheaper and whatnot, and we'll show you around. And then when I finally got there, a few hours after they did, they picked me up from the airport. And then I found out that I was going to be by myself in the next 3 weeks.
Oh.
Yeah, they're just like, oh, things change, plans change. You know, one guy was like, hey, like, I have to catch an earlier flight back home. It's like, you know, a little complicated, what's going on here. And the other one was like, you know, I'll show you around for a little bit, but, you know, I got to be with my family. And it's, you know, like, can't really stay over at our place. Totally understandable. The other one is like, my family's not going to let me hang out with some boy I met at a bar like the night before.
So how did you feel when you realized you were by yourself?
Kind of knew it was too good to be true. Like how everything came together so quickly in like 24 hours, 36 hours, was just too good to be true. And I knew something was up. There's always something. And that's the great thing about traveling. The good and I guess the scary thing about traveling is it's kind of like a marriage. The only way to do it wrong is to think that you can control it.
Interesting.
And that was the first thing, like something was out of my control. Like things were happening. I think it was like the beginning. It was like the winter of 2010. So it was the beginning of the Arab Spring. You could see things of it happening. And I think that caused a lot of stuff to go down where general travel concerns and people feeling it wasn't safe. And I totally get and that probably why is why my tickets went down from 3,000 to 650 all of a sudden. Just being a part of that vibe and being in that travel thing, just like, boom, your first trip is going to be this challenge, being alone for the next 3 weeks, being by yourself was crazy. And I actually considered their advice of, you know, just not spending as long as I planned to and just going home early or just going home that day because I didn't know anybody. Nobody knew me. I didn't bring anything, didn't prepare much, didn't speak the language.
Right. So in one of your blog posts, Forming a Monsoon Alone in Cairo, you actually write something that I thought was really beautiful that I'm going to read really quick.
Sure.
You wrote, for the first time in my life, I felt an odd, confusing mixture of diametrically opposed emotions. I was structureless, I was formless, and I felt refreshingly yet uneasily liberated. I knew nobody and nobody knew me. I wasn't meeting anyone, wasn't about to run into anyone, and I had no means to reach other people and nobody could reach me. Nobody was going to call me or give me a plan or tell me what to do. I couldn't even understand any of the advertisements telling me what to buy or what to watch. Everything was a blank to me. I was wandering in oblivion. There was nothing and nobody in that moment whom I could communicate with other than myself. So can you elaborate on, you know, what you were feeling?
Thank you for choosing that passage. That was a big turning point in my life. I mean, I think the big thing that most of us are trying to do in life is to get a good sense of our own identity. That, to me, was a time where I became aware of myself. I think most of us, unfortunately, go through our entire lives without ever feeling comfortable being in our own skin. And what I mean by that is that we live in a society now where people are always constantly stimulated externally, which means you always have to worry about an assignment or a job requirement or the next test, the next exam, the next essay, the next paper, the next thing you have to do for your work. And then anytime we have a free moment, most of us, if not all of us, are now are tied to social media in some capacity. So we're always stimulated by what somebody posted on their Facebook or right. Instagram or anything. So we never have a space just to ourselves where we can just talk to ourselves. And I don't mean that like talking to ourselves like literally, but more just, are you comfortable being alone without anything else other than your own thoughts? And a lot of people aren't because they haven't even been given that space.
Before this moment, did you have that space before? Or was this in Egypt being the first time?
Egypt was the first time. It was the first time because I remember before this was all New York for me. And New York, I mean, even if I wanted to take a walk alone without my phone or a computer, there will always be someone I could possibly run into. There would always be a billboard or an advertisement or something in a language I could understand that would lead me there and then run into, you know, or meet new people. It just never felt unfamiliar, right? Even like if you take a trip to the woods and do hiking in the middle of the Adirondacks in New York, you're going to meet somebody that will speak your language.
Right.
You're going to see an advertisement for Coca-Cola, and you're never going to feel like you're by yourself and alone. Now, being in Egypt, I didn't understand anything. I didn't know anybody. Nobody knew me. I wasn't going to run into anyone. I couldn't even understand what was like written on TV or a billboard advertisement. Like for the first time ever, the only person that I could talk to was myself, you know, in my thoughts. And I think it's similar for a lot of people who are meditating for the first time. Their monkey brain, like it's just so hard to meditate when like your brain is thinking about all these other things that, you know, it's a challenge to meditate for the first couple of days or weeks trying it out. And to me, this was very similar. Just being traveling alone was kind of like a meditative experience where I didn't know anybody and nobody knew me. And all I could think about was my own thoughts and being comfortable in, you know, being alone, eating alone, and traveling alone.
Do you remember your first words, if you will, to yourself, or your first thoughts?
The first words was like, oh, fuck, I'm fucked. It was, I'm so screwed. I don't have to beat that out. But like literally that was like, and I was like left alone in that Cairo train station, and they like all like, are you going to be okay? And I'm like, I'm going to be fine. And they all just left. And I was finally by myself alone, knowing that I would be alone for the next 2 or 3 weeks with no one else that I could run into that I knew. I was like, shit, I'm literally fucked. And because I had never been in that situation where I had to fend for myself without having any resources at my like immediate disposal. Like, if I were in New York alone, right? In New York, it's my home. I know it very well. Or anywhere in the United States, I speak the language. And I can just find anyone to get help or go online. Here at the time was like, I don't know how to eat. Like, how am I going to find food? Even like the smallest things that we take for granted at home became a huge challenge. Where to eat, where to sleep, where to like, you know, we don't think about those things back home.
So how did you decide the next steps?
I walked around in circles for like 2 hours. It was like watching, as I always tell people, it's like watching like a 3-year-old play The Sims for the first time. You see this like character just like, blah, 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 like, you know, like walking circles. And it's like, oh, I have no idea. I was like bumping into walls, picking up things that weren't there, just so it seemed like a good blend in. I definitely didn't blend in. Eventually, like going back and forth, I was like, you know what? If I like change my flights so I can leave today, go back home to New York and just say like, I'll just save this challenge for later. There's a 100% chance I'll live. There's a 100% chance I'd regret it. If I like decide to just jump the deep end and buy a one-way ticket to wherever city in Egypt and just check it out and just be alone and just see what I can do, there's a 20% chance I'll live, but 100% chance I won't regret it. I'm already here. And I, you know, took my odds and I bought a one-way ticket to Alexandria that night and then just went without any plan or purpose. That train ride was a comedy of errors of people trying to figure out why I was there and trying to, you know, just figure out if I was, you know, going to survive the trip at all.
Wow.
Because I had no plan. I was like, what are you doing in Alexandria? And I'm like, oh, I'm going to see the great lighthouse of Alexandria, or the great Alexandrian library that I read about in the history books. And they were like, they were all like confused because those two things like burned down like thousands of years ago. Alexander the Great destroyed one of those things. They were all gone now, and I was going to see them, and it doesn't make quite any sense. So they helped me out, and they gave me a few advice, taught me a little bit Arabic, met other travelers who were way more seasoned than I am. And then, when I got to the Alexandria train station, I was so scared of even crossing the street. I like walked out, turned around, and got a cab to an address of a place that took in like backpackers. The cab was like, are you sure about this? And then I was like, yeah, why? And he like literally drives across the street for like 5 seconds. And I was like, yep, here.
That's so funny. Because New Yorkers are renowned for their ability to cross any street.
Yeah.
You can just jaywalk anywhere.
Exactly. I paid 10 pounds to do it legally. And I ended up spending that first week. Every passing minute was like, I'm going to die. I'm going to die. I'm going to die. I don't know what to do. I don't know what to do. I don't know what to do. Then the second week, I was like, okay, I'm getting the hang of this. And then the third week was when I realized, like, finally, after 3 weeks of just constant discomfort and feeling scared and hating traveling alone and hating traveling in general, It's not until like 3 weeks in, I was like, okay, I get, I'm like actually at peace with myself. I'm comfortable with myself. I look back on 3 weeks of, you know, staying alive in, you know, traveling. I realized it wasn't a big deal. But what was a bigger deal was I can trust myself. Like I now knew what I was capable of. And it was a small step for me to realize that I can now start living a life of loving myself and trusting myself.
That's really deep. I mean, I feel like the immersion part is so necessary. And I also feel like sometimes we have this idea where when we're kids, it's easy to like dive into something. But when we're older, we're like aware that we're bad at it at the beginning. And so we're less likely to follow through with it all the way, unless you are immersed.
I wrote about how, I don't know if I wrote in my blog, but I write about sometimes, and I speak about when we're born, when we come out of the womb, right?
Yeah.
It's a sandbox. We could do whatever we want. We would have no idea that what gender we are, what race, what culture, where we grew up, like anything is possible, right? It's only, and then that's where we like have that curiosity in the world. It's not until over time, over the years, when society, the overwhelming pressure of whatever society or culture or household you're raised in starts treating us differently because how they see us. Oh, you should do this because you're a woman. Oh, you have these expectations because you're a man. Or you have to do this because you're cis or trans or you're gay or you're straight or whatever the labels that society places on us, that's very overwhelming for us. And we have to develop habits in order to survive. And then we become influenced and molded by these labels, you know, by religion, mm-hmm. culture, our parents and whatnot. And then we start losing the curiosity and fearlessness that we had when we didn't have these labels to abide by, right?
Yeah.
I, as a man, will be living very differently if I had been born a woman or trans or a religion, you know, of some religion or a different culture or of a different race. It would be completely different. And as a result, we forget what it means to live, you know, limitlessly, if you will.
Speaking of limitlessly, tell us about the time you crashed a wedding in Pakistan. You have great pictures. There's one where you're on stage, you're dancing, or are you always dancing?
Yeah, that one. That was actually pretty much crazy than I thought looking back. Let's just go bring back to like 2013. I was speaking at this conference in CUNY Baruch. And it was a big audience, actually. I was invited to speak on a panel about my time in North Korea, 2011. And one of the audience members came up to me, and it was like about 10 to 20 people who like I talked to that conference. It was like really brief, like 4 or 5 seconds. And I was like shaking everyone's hand and whatnot. And I guess he remembered me, but cut the scene to like 2 years later, I'm in Pakistan because my girlfriend at the time, her cousin was getting married, and my girlfriend was born in Pakistan, raised in Hawaii. She's half Pakistani, half Filipina, and her family was going to go for her cousin's wedding. And her cousin, whom I met when she was in New York, invited me as well, and I was not going to pass up this opportunity to go. And luckily, it was right after another trip. I was already traveling, to Antarctica. So it was just this series of crazy things. Like, I'm in Antarctica. And then after Antarctica was over, I was like, I'm in Pakistan. And dates lined up and everything. And I was there. And I learned the choreography for the Mendi. I did a little bit of choreography of my own because I did some South Asian dance back in college on the teams. And everyone loved it. I did the Mendi. I was there at the Bharat. I was there for the Balima. And I went all the way down to Karachi. And then that was over. And once the whole week-long wedding festivities were over, I went back to Lahore just to explore. And then that family was like, hey, you know, like there's another wedding that we might go to last minute. Do you want to come? Like, they don't know you're coming. So I go. And there was like this whole Mendi thing again. And they were like, Calvin, we saw you dance in the last wedding. You should definitely crash this. And I was like, I know, and I'll go up there. I have nothing to lose because I don't know anybody. Nobody knows me. This is 4 years after Egypt, so I think I've come a long way.
how many places had you traveled over those 4 years? Do you remember?
I think I was at 60 countries by then, 60 to 70, by the time I hit 4 years in.
And this should be, it's important to note that this was during medical school also that you were doing all this traveling.
Right. It was I was a full-time medical student. I was doing about 8 to 15 countries a year, and I, without skipping a day of class or anything or getting in trouble.
So nobody can make any excuses that it's not possible.
Well, yeah, I mean, that was, thank you. Yeah, that there is no excuse. I am not the smartest person in my class. In fact, I almost didn't quite make it through medical school because I was definitely not the smartest person in my class. I'm definitely not the hardest working because I went traveling a lot. But I didn't skip anything. I never flaked on anything. I never not shown up for anything. And if I could do it, I believe that anyone else can if they not necessarily put their mind to it, because this was not my goal. My goal actually was, I had no goals. I was trying to figure out how many places I can go in the heat of the moment. I was just like, oh, I have the weekend off. Let's see where I can go. What's cheap? What flights are under like $200, $300. And I was just throwing things at the wall and seeing what stuck. I didn't expect to hit 60 to 70 countries during my 4 years in medical school. Started from day one. So that was not my goal. But I hope that other people can take from this. If I had no goal and I was just doing things as they were coming along, and I was able to hit 70 countries and still make it past medical school without being the best in the class, other people should at least derive some kind of spark or inspiration from my story to say that if you're ever feeling burnt out, if you're ever feeling like you're just outweighed by the pressures of medical school, it is possible just to get out even for a little bit, 1 or 2 days. You can get out of the country on a cheap flight, use miles, or do it for free, or contact me and I'll find some kind of magic solution, because it is always possible. I think mental health is a big important thing in medical school, and I think burnout is when you do the same thing over and over and over and over again without anything to break up the routine. And for me, that was traveling. And I really want people to get thrive from that. But anyway, back to Pakistan. I was dancing, and the guy that I met in CUNY Baruch came up to me and he was like, do you remember me? I said hi to you, Baruch, like 2 years ago. And I happened to be like family friends with this wedding that you're now crashing. What a small world. I can't get away from anyone.
And what was the crowd's reaction when you came out there? Were they shocked?
It's like the five stages of grief. Shock. Anger. No, just kidding. It was shock, glee, bargaining. Can you come to my wedding? Can you come to our wedding? Can you like come to our Mendy and we'll beat the other, we'll beat the groom's side, we'll beat the bride's side. And again, not depression, I guess. I guess depression, because I have to go like the next day. I had to leave. It was just wild how small the world it was, even at this like random wedding in the middle of Lahore.
That's awesome. And then you've been to 60 countries, you got through med school, you matched. Somewhere along the way, you decided that this could actually become a business. Can you talk about that?
It was pretty organic. I really believe in the mantra of like a lot of entrepreneurs out there. Not a lot, just a couple entrepreneurs. I just heard this. Sorry. This mantra I really like, don't create a business, create a movement. And that really resonated with me, because now looking back, what I have in the Monsoon Diaries, I never set out for it to become a business.
Right.
I created the Monsoon Diaries as a blog to let people around the world, or at least people back home and my mom, to know I was okay. And I blog live, right? I blog every day while I'm traveling. I've never given up on that discipline, except for one exception, and that was when I was in North Korea and a couple of days in Antarctica. We didn't have internet. That was it. Every day I travel, I blog. And I blog even the good – I blog the good things, and I blog all the bad things. And in medical school, I would write – I'm literally like finishing an exam, and I'm about to – this is my plan, and I'm not sure if I'm going to make it. I'm going to go to this party that I'm throwing for my class, and then I'm going to take my bags to the club, check it in, and take the bags out to the airport, make it in time to get that night flight out to meet up with like five other people. And people will read this, and they'll be like, he's actually making it work. Or there are times where it didn't work. And it's like, he's actually a real person,
right,
that makes mistakes. I really want to join along. And obviously, I do not say no if I've never done it before. So when people ask me, can I bring them? I said, sure. Yeah, of course. And they would ask if they could bring their friends. And that I would say yes to that. And eventually, this snowballed into a small community of people that all did not know one another that would travel with me and then break off and travel on their own or go back home and meet other people who have traveled with me. And they would start taking like reunion photos or meeting up with one another and sending me photos like, hey, we never met until today, but we both found that we both traveled with you, right? We're looking forward to the next monsoon, right? Then they started calling it monsoon. They started calling themselves monsooners. This is before I even thought of creating a lingo based on my blog thing, right. But they were doing it for me. So this community was creating itself, and eventually they came back and was like, hey, I want to go on a trip. Can you organize another one? Or these like very seasoned backpackers is like, you know what? I'm getting lazy. I don't want to plan another trip. I want you to do everything because I know you enjoy it. And then eventually I was just like, all right, like I was happy to do it. And there would be people who would come in and say like, hey, I'm willing to pay you so-and-so for this trip. Or like, hey, I just went on this trip with you. I'm going to pay you back. How much did it cost? And I'll tell them X amount. And they were like flabbergasted. It was like, oh my God, I expected to be like hundreds of dollars more. Right. And I was like, all right, I'll take that money. but eventually they were like, no, you know, eventually it became a business. They were like, you know, if you really want to make money off this, you can. But I didn't like do anything. It was my friend who incorporated it for me, taught me everything and turned it into what it is today. But I really don't want people to feel like it's a company first. It's more of like a movement. It's a, right. It's a community of people who created itself. And I'm only happy to go and come along for the ride. Like this was never my idea. And this community now it runs itself. Like there are plenty of people who now travel under the monsoon banner and I just give them my blessings. Some of them lead trips on their own without me leading groups of people there. And now I'm getting a major FOMO knowing that there are other people that in the monsoon community that I will have never met and but looking forward to on the next trip.
And I'm having FOMO too. I'm like, I need to get on the next trip.
There's one this weekend, there's one next weekend, and there's one the end of next month. So there's plenty of opportunities, man.
What's the average trip length?
It depends on the trip itself and where we're going. So we did like places like – we do places like Europe, for example. It's free for all. It's just me planning things to places I've never been to before. And people just have to get their flights – and to show me their commitment and pay me whatever the trip cost is. The first step is to meet me, whether it's at the airport flying there, but most of the time it's at the destination itself. And then we hit the ground running. And it's I've never been there before, so they're not paying me to be like a tour guide. They're just paying for lodging and accommodations of things that I researched the week before, and I'm just really just going with the flow. But really the style is trying to bring group travel to people who hate group traveling. Yeah. So it's just generally a bunch of people together, just seeing everything as if we were doing it for the first time. We are actually not as if. Seeing things for the first time with somebody that has never done it before, getting into trouble organically, learning from it, and, like getting out of trouble organically, learning together, and then having a lot of free time to do with the things that we want. So in the first couple of hours, we'll see all the obligatory things, all the things that we have to check the box on, like the giant church, the biggest thing in the world, the biggest X in the world, the only X this in the world. Anyway, we'll do all those things in the first day. And then the rest of the time we're there, the next 1 or 2 days is free time. And I'll do what I want to do. And other people can either follow me into their own thing. Some people meet other people, other locals, and either stay behind or, you know, break off and travel and meet up with me another time. It's totally open up to you. I am happy to help you organize it.
You really build this community like you're mentioning before. I'm curious, what characteristics have you seen in other people who travel like this? Like people you've met, you know, other travelers who are like, oh, I'm doing this, you know, trip across the world.
All right. To basically see a trip, I said, we're going to a place, a blank country in Europe. Calvin's never been there before. We're going to figure this out together, right? That self-selects for a certain group of people. Mm-hmm. And the ones that are a little more organized, as you will, the like young pioneer tours, when we went to Antarctica, we found this ocean-wide expeditions that organized this cruise for us and had everything planned out in terms of, you know, it's like a cruise. And or North Korea, when we went, it was an agency that organized everything for us. We had a tour bus. There's nothing like where we could travel alone and be independent. Those are things. They all balance out to self-select for a group of people that are looking for some kind of adventure, or somebody who is going through something in life, some kind of life transition, mm-hmm. that is looking for a trip like this, something that that isn't exactly completely throw themselves into oblivion by themselves, which is ultimately what I want for everyone, to feel comfortable traveling alone or just being alone, right?
Right.
Somebody who needs a little bit of structure, but not like as to so much as that where some everything's planned out, including your meals. This self-selects for a group of people who are looking for some kind of adventure, who are going through something in life where they want to break out of their shells and get out of their comfort zones without completely losing themselves into complete oblivion. It's that little balance of both.
Yeah.
While using us as a platform to eventually, hopefully, develop the confidence to be by themselves, to travel alone, to hopefully my goals for everyone is to not having to need my services or the Monsoon Diaries.
See, I like that. That's empowering.
I am bringing the nest to you, and you can circle around the nest alone. But ultimately, I want to take you to fly and spread your wings without the nest.
And it almost seems like the reason this works, even as a business, is the fact that it's something you love to do to begin with.
That's so true, because it's like creating a movement is, I did not set out to create this in the beginning. I said this to just travel alone and to let other people know I was okay. And people just follow me just like any other travel writer or blogger out there. But when people start to see that this person is not, like for myself, I'm not trying to get people to do things. I'm not forcing people to travel. I didn't set this out to say I'm going to have a travel community, right? If the moment you start doing that, people will be like, so we'll be able to sniff out the BS. He's like, this guy doesn't care about traveling. This guy cares about making money. And that's the wrong way to travel. That is the wrong way to start this. I don't care if I go alone on a trip, right? This next week, I'm going on a trip to Kurdistan, Iraq. And so far, no one really signed up yet. And I already bought my tickets. And I'm prepared to go alone. I have booked everything as if I'm going alone. I don't care. Like, I am happy to do this alone. If you're willing to come along for the ride, that's great. And in that honesty and that organicness that I've always tried to I've always just put into my trips feeling and style, I think is what draws people, has an irony of drawing more people to what we do. I guess not Iraq. I think that's the only exception. But I still have a week and a half, right? And my last trip to Central Europe, by the way, I was going to go alone. And within a week, I had 11 people come.
Wow.
All by random coincidences or like Insta stories that I responded to or a friend of a friend who just happened to be there. All just came together in the week. So I don't know. Maybe knock on wood. In a week and a half to Iraq, I'll get a group of people. But yeah, that's because I go into it just fully comfortable doing it alone. And I think that's what draws people, right? If the moment you start looking thirsty and desperate and like, hey, people, I need people to come, otherwise I'm not going to travel. no one's going to come. Everyone's going to be pushed away. It's kind of like a magnet, you know?
When you go on these travels by yourself, how do you create community with locals? You know, what are some techniques you have to meet people?
I actually am more of like a wallflower when I travel. I try not to disturb what is around me when I'm traveling. I just want to just blend in and just observe things as if I were never there. So I get the most honest thing. I just don't want people to like come up to me and be like, oh, let me completely change my lifestyle because a tourist is watching me and a foreigner's saying I got to like do, you know, the thing I got to do for the foreigners to take photos in for. I don't like that. I like things to be organic and real. So tend to kind of just be in the background and not try to interact too much because I don't want to be disingenuous. And I just want a truly genuine experience and without leaving much of a footprint. But our irony, as we just talked about, Asaf, is that the less you do, the more people are come to you. You know what I mean? Like,
Right. Because
you're so genuine and honest and trying to not disturb the peace, the right people will come to you, right? If you're out looking, like, I want to hang out with the local. I want to meet other people. I want to meet other like locals and get to know the local traditions. The right people, the good people are going to like run away from you. Like, you're just going to get the people who, you know, are there because they have to be there and they're playing some kind of role. So I think that being said, the irony of just being by yourself and being genuine and and keeping to yourself and being very respectful of the environment around you, right people will come up to you. And when they come up to us, I'm not going to be an asshole and push them away. I'm very friendly and approachable if you come up to me. But it has to come from you, and it has to be something there that is genuine and honest. And if you're not, if it's a local that's not trying to sell me anything, but more or less trying to get to know us and want us to get to know them, I am more than happy to go with the flow. And that what ends up happening is that that honest dialogue and that genuine feeling that you start off with just becomes this, creates this momentum where one thing leads to another. We meet their friends and then meet their friends of their friends. And all of a sudden you have a large community that you're part of in that country or that place that will never forget you. I have on my website, you'll see monsoondiaries.com/friends, 6 pages of hundreds of people that I met around the world who we all have stories with. And each one of them is a picture of them plus a little blurb of how we met and a little story. And you get on there because we had an organic story that came in without forcing it. And that's essentially, I think, what I'm looking for is honesty, an honest travel experience. So how I meet them, there's no like how-to guy. The only thing I can say is just be yourself. And be in the moment, be present, and the right people, whoever they are around the world, will come to you.
So I really like that. And I want to quickly segue before we come back to traveling, because I want to give you a little bit of love. Throughout your career, through undergrad, medical school even, and even through Monsoon Diaries, you've held many leadership roles. In fact, even Columbia University gave you the Leadership Legend Award, which is the highest honor for university leadership. And everything you're saying about, you know, creating a movement, being organic, being genuine, I think are like really admirable leadership traits. So I kind of want to ask the philosopher within you, what do you think about leadership? Like, what's your philosophy on what makes a good leader?
Everyone is so different. There's so many different leadership styles. It really just depends on knowing what kind of leader you are. And that takes a lot of self-awareness. I think being a good leader, first and foremost, if there is something, anything that's universal that can be derived from the fluffy thing I just said would be know yourself. A good leader knows themselves truly, thoroughly, and completely, that they are able to trust themselves even when they don't have all the facts, even if they don't have all the resources available. By trusting themselves, and they become the example, and they set the example that every good leader should. So given any situation, anyone would want to follow a leader that knows themselves the best, that they can trust themselves in even the hardest of decisions.
Do you think leadership comes naturally to you?
It depends on the situation. Like, I think if you know yourself well, if you trust and know yourself and you're self-aware and you love yourself and you believe that you have what it takes, even if you don't have all the resources at your disposal, any situation is manageable to you, right? Because you're the foundation. You're the rock, right? No matter what, no matter how crazy it is out there, because you have a strong sense of foundation, you will maintain your roots and your foundations without being pushed over or blown away. Now, for myself, I like the idea of that I can be adaptable and flexible because of my previous travel experiences, but I'm always presented with a challenge where I feel like I may not be the perfect leader in this capacity scenario. So it would behoove me to say that I am a great leader in all situations, because I'm not.
Right.
But what I think is an important aspect of a good leader is the confidence, right? With confidence in yourself, confidence in know yourself, but also the confidence to say, I don't know, mm-hmm. right? The best leader, the most confident person that I can ever think of is somebody who is confident enough to say, I don't know enough about this. I don't have all what it takes to tackle the situation, but I'm willing to ask questions. I'm willing to learn. I'm willing to get down and dirty and learn the hard thing rather than only choosing scenarios where I'm comfortable with. Then you're never going to grow as a leader if you do the latter, mm-hmm. right? So am I the best? Do I consider myself with good leadership qualities? It's hard to say. It depends on the situation of what I've experienced. But I would like to say that I have a quality that I respect in other leaders, which is being adaptable and being questionable and being willing to accept my flaws and my shortcomings and willing to ask questions and show my ignorance in a certain situation so I can learn more and be better for future situations.
And what advice do you have for travelers or people who want to travel other than just jumping in?
Oh, yeah, that was going to be it. Yeah, the hardest decision is the decision to travel, right? That is mm-hmm. the hardest decision. The second advice is there's no how-to guide, right? You don't read. When you get on a bike for the first time or you go skydiving for the first time, you're not going to open up a manual on how to ride a bike or mm-hmm. how to skydive. You just do it. And the fear is falling down off a bike or your parachute not opening. But at the end of the day, how else are you going to learn? I mean, the parachute not opening, and that's it, right? But that's not – but you also have to take in probability and statistics. The chances of something bad happening to you at home is much higher than traveling to most places in the world. Most, not all, most places in the world. Like my job in the Bronx as an ER doctor, and if I'm working in the future in the Brooklyn or wherever else in New York or East New York or other places – and the ER is much more dangerous than anywhere I have ever been to before, even Kurdistan, Iraq.
Can you elaborate on that really quick? What makes it so dangerous?
Oh, I mean, like if you're working, like, for example, my alma mater is SUNY Downstate, Kings County, by Crown Heights, Flatbush, right? That has a reputation for not going, you shouldn't go out at night. Or I work in the Bronx, so certain areas, like across the street, some guy got shot in the face. The back mm-hmm. of the head on one of our days off in the middle of the day, actually, right across the street from our emergency room. And that's the same where he got shot. It's the same place where I buy, you know, my acai bowls, you know, it's crazy what, like, the things that go around our hospital. And that's why the hospitals are there, because they're serving a community that needs, you know, healthcare stat. Walking across the street, walking out, finishing my shift and walking across the street where people get shot, where I usually get my, like, protein bars or whatever, or that bag of potato chips, is things I don't have to worry about when I'm going to places in Europe or South Asia or going to a wedding in Pakistan or, you know, North Korea on a tour group, right? The chances of being shot in those areas is much lower than the day-to-day, like, traumas that we get from people getting shot or hit by a car, like, 20 times a day. At Jacoby, where I work right now. And these are all in our neighborhood.
So you have this unique perspective of being in a high-need area where you practice medicine. You have this extensive global experience. So I'm curious, does your travels inform your views on global health in any way? Like, are you thinking about that as you travel?
So said before, I don't want to force anything. I like things to come together organically and naturally. So when I started traveling, I was very aware of the danger, the temptation to combine traveling with medicine because I was already in medical school mm-hmm. and to turn that into, like, hey, I'm traveling for global health. Oh, look how cool it is. I actually decided not to do that because, again, it would just sound so forced and so cliche. If it were going to happen, it would have to happen organically, naturally, without planning, it just had to happen, like, honestly, right? And honestly, at the time, I didn't feel like I was ready to combine the two. I just loved traveling, or what traveling brought to me for my mental well-being, my mental health, to allow me to stave off burnout and survive medical school and thrive in residency. Now, the thing with genuine honesty is that as long as you have that, your worldview and what you see through your eyes is cleared, right? You're not going through life with this ulterior motive clouding your judgments and your plans. You're just going in honestly without any expectations, right? Because I didn't have any expectations. I was going completely free, open to anything. And I was – my world and the way I see the world is completely clear from the fog of like ulterior motivations or intentions. Now, going there clearly, you start seeing more things than most other people would not see if they went in, like, with a certain, like, goal in mind, right? I went in without any goals, without any expectations. I just want to travel and see things as they are, being the wallflower. Mm-hmm. And yes, I've definitely seen the inequities and started really taking it and appreciating the connection and the similarities and the differences between the inequities and disparities of healthcare in those communities I served in the Bronx, New York, back home, and as well as the inequities and disparities of problems abroad, where I go to places that are considered more developing countries. So being able to connect it to realize that there is a translational component to medicine. Some aren't because of cultural differences, but some are in terms of empathy and just being there for people when they want just understanding what's going on with their health in a very difficult time in their lives. That is translatable, but that came as a growing emergence and understanding of just human health that is universal across the world. But, you know, what can I do to implement that as a program, quote unquote, the label global health? I want to take it organically. I want to let it come naturally and genuinely so that it feels like it comes from myself and not by the influence of other people. And I'm grateful to say that there is a trip that I am planning to Haiti the end of next May. I've been to Haiti before just as a tourist and a traveler, like about 2 years after the earthquake, and just seeing what could be done. But I was a second-year medical student at the time. Mm-hmm. Now going back as a fourth year finishing or graduating resident, about to become an attending in 2 months, if you know, knock on wood, if
yeah, that's a mind trip, huh?
going back. Now I'm more capable of doing something, but already having been there, just seeing what you know what can be done, is just more empowering, right? And it's a program that I found totally accidentally, totally just hit a spark with me, and their mission of making it sustainable. And not something where, no offense, those programs have just taken anyone, right? Those students or pre-meds, right? At the end of the day, you're just taking up a lot of room when this program only takes licensed professionals. It's like, we need you to actually do things, right? Which I believe in disaster relief work is that you want to go in and you want to get out, right? You don't want to stay too long where people become dependent on you. You want to empower the local population to be self-reliant and sustainable. That means respecting their resources and respecting what they already have and what they already know, and not believing that you're the savior of everyone, right? You're just going to go in because you're going to provide things that they're lacking because of a disaster. They're not going to be able to create power, you know, structures if their power plants are down. You go in with power, you set it up, and you get out once they get their power back online, right? You know, those things that you can do without taking over, I think is what I truly believe in terms of sustainability and global health. And that all came from just the organicness and genuineness of the way I see the world and how you should approach different people and different cultures while trying to create that connection and sharing. You know, I don't think we should be isolationist, but I also don't think we should be heavy-handed. So there's like a balance.
Yeah. In addition to your travel life, you have another life as a speaker, including a TED Talk you gave called Take the Path of More Resistance. And all of the links to them will be available in the show notes on the website. But how did you establish this speaking circuit you do? You've spoken at more than 200 places. And how did you even find yourself falling into that?
That's kind of funny that you mentioned that, because people who are listening to this, the people who are still listening to this episode are probably like, wow, he loves talking about himself. Being a speaker is something that I am very grateful for. It started off in 2009 where this keynote speaker for this conference in Florida dropped out at the last minute, and they needed one desperately. So they asked me if I could come and speak for free, and this is my first opportunity to. And obviously the reasons was very similar to what I just said. Hey, Calvin, you love talking about yourself. Do you want to come and talk about yourself?
And so why did they choose you? Where did they hear of you, and what story were they, did they want you to share?
I guess I love talking about myself. No, I was just starting to be a leader on the East Coast Asian American Student Union, ICASU. It's the oldest and largest Asian American organization, intercollegiate Asian American organization in the country, founded in 1977. It has very amazing grassroots coalition building origins of working with Black students in the San Francisco State University, the Third World, standing in solidarity with them for ethnic studies and against reverse affirmative action. So the roots of Asian Americans working with, you know, the Black community and, you know, our writes on that was something that spoke a lot to me. Where I want to be right now in terms of coalition building with other communities in a grassroots kind of way. That's something that I signed up for in 2009, became alumni chair, and then lucky enough to be taken on as the board of directors, the director of the organization for the next 10 years. And just during that, I guess, fast rise allowed me to be exposed to a lot of people from all over the country in our annual spring conferences. And I met a bunch of people in Florida who went to, a workshop that I took over on breakdancing. I just knew the people who were doing the breakdancing workshop at Cornell 2008. And they just asked me to help out. So I taught a little breakdancing. And one thing led to another, social media, whatnot. They knew one of my stories back in high school, how I got involved in Asian American and the minority movement was pretty inspiring. So they asked me to come speak about that, but not knowing what to expect because they were getting me for free. They were saving all that money for better programming. And I came and I spoke and they transcribed it. They put it on the web. The transcription is still up there. And other people saw it. They read it. And then they invited me as well. That got put up on the web and then it snowballed. People started referring me to other people. And then eventually, like, now I do a ton of speaking engagements.
Oh, that's awesome. All right. So before we end, I want to do a little rapid fire round.
Yeah, sure.
If you could have dinner with anyone in the world, who would it be?
Oh, man. Alive or dead?
Let's go with alive.
Anthony Bourdain.
Ooh, that's a good one. Have you read his book?
Yes, The Nasty Bits.
That one, and then there's Kitchen Confidential.
Kitchen Confidential, his first one, yeah. I like how honest and real he is. Like, he's the consummate gentleman asshole that I identify with. He is honest, and I believe in honesty. I believe in just putting your cards on the table and take me for who I am. You don't like me because I'm an asshole? Too bad. And it ends up that irony, that genuineness and honesty gets him a CNN TV show or Travel Channel to CNN, right? People just love that honesty. It's like Tony Stark versus Captain America. Captain America's a goody two-shoes, but a lot of people like Tony Stark because he's honest about him being Iron Man.
Right.
He's honest about being an asshole. And you don't like him? Too bad, right? And to me, that speaks volumes of the genuineness, the honesty, the right people. I'm surrounding myself with the right people who are able to penetrate through the layers and layers of assholeness that we create for ourselves as like a self-defense mechanism because of, I guess, wherever it is, I guess Tony Stark or Anthony Bourdain or wherever it is, tons of trauma, a little tough life growing up with things that happened to all of us. And tons of privilege and recognizing that privilege of what we had when growing up and then combining the two, and the right people will see through all those layers to see a real person. And those are the people that we like to keep around us. And for Anthony Bourdain to just do his own thing and then being recognized for it and doing exactly the things that I, you know, love to do now is, you know, and how he sees and enjoys and lives life with, by the way, is not just a glutton. I mean, he does all these things that just seem gluttonous. He has all this awareness of the world and the iniquities of our past, like whatever it's colonialism or war or, you know, privilege that other societies have put upon others, and just being aware, going in and making others aware of all these things that we take for granted, I think is very commendable and remarkable.
And then speaking of Bourdain, what's your favorite meal that you've ever had?
So it depends. This is not rapid fire anymore. North Korea, they cook something for tourists, which is ironic because North Korea is like awful in terms of that. But I can't lie. I'm an honest person.
Yeah.
The best I've ever had was when they combined for the tourists this Beijing Peking duck, Korean barbecue style. Singapore and Malaysia, the intersections of all these cultures, the Malay, South Asian, East Asian, all those influences coming together for those hawker stars are amazing. Those $3 things are some of the best things I've ever eaten. But there's also fine dining. I've been to places that around the country and around the world where, you know, they create fine dining and their version of fine dining that if I list it out for you, people roll their eyes and say, wow, what a jerk.
Uh-huh.
But I have been very grateful to have access to those things, most of which are through friends or through connections that, you know, I'm not going to pass up a free meal or discounted meal if it's offered, especially if it's, you know, good value.
Right. Any books you recommend?
I would recommend for those starting out, The Alchemist by Paul Coelho. I know some people roll their eyes on that because it's very cliche and everyone has probably read it in middle school, but I think it's still very inspiring. It's just so simple. And if you haven't read anything else and you are just starting off, it's a great first book to get you in the mindset of putting yourself out there and getting out of your comfort zone. The other one that's a little more, if you have the time, don't watch the movie. You haven't watched the movie, The Life of Pi.
Yes.
So sorry, good. Not The Life of Pi. That's also an amazing book about traveling and getting yourself out there and just creating your own world, your own reality, whatever it helps you to live and survive and thrive.
And then what are your top three favorite places to go?
Oh, God, that's so tough of a question. I guess the most fascinating will be a tie between North Korea and Myanmar. Like, this is like the most out of the world, out of body experiences I've been to. Like, time machine, until we have a time machine, those are the closest you're going to get. Natural beauty wise, it would be Antarctica and Namibia, a tie between those two. So different, but so like amazing and also out of the world. The most fun I ever had was in Cuba. There was a group of 50 people in my travel group. We became best friends. Not one person got left out. I just thought it was uncanny how like a week of 50 people, all who hate group traveling, ended up loving that trip. Independent backpackers. It's so ironic. They just love group travel after that, in certain conditions. The most underrated country is Slovenia. I know we're going past three now.
Okay.
The most magical place is New Zealand, which I just did 3 months ago. The country that I will never fail to mention is a country I go back to over and over and over again because it always brings me back. There's always some person there, some event there that brings me back. And as I say, I was trying to go to a place I've never been to before. This is the exception. It would be India.
That's awesome.
And no, that's about it.
Do you remember all the places you visited?
Yeah, it's like my children. It's like, how do you forget them? My travel experiences and memories are the most striking to me. I remember every country. I may not remember every single detail because I don't have photographic memory, but I am blessed that before any of this happened, I started a blog.
Right.
I blogged every day. And I can go back to any country that I wake up and I'm like, oh my God, what happened there that I need to like remember? Like, I don't want this to lose this memory. I have a blog. I can click on that country in the map that I have on my front page and then go to that blog post and relive everything all over again. So I do remember. I do remember all countries, but if I were not able to, I have a blog in print that I can always refer to.
Right. It's really the power of writing too. I feel like it's combining everything from the self-awareness portion that you talked about to even remembering the trip afterwards.
Oh, yeah. I think the reason why I call them Monsoon Diaries is because I've kept a diary and a journal since I was 5, 6 years old. I still am looking at it right now, my 5 to 6 year old diary, followed by my 3 black and white marble notebooks that I had in elementary school, middle school, high school. And then I have a Zenga that took over since high school. And Zenga all the way, the last entry of Zenga, that date is also the first date of my first blog post, the Monsoon Diaries.
That's awesome.
So I never had a hiccup.
And then, have you ever gotten sick on a trip?
Oh, yeah. I got sick on my first trip, my first couple of trips. Now I have a stomach made out of steel. But yeah, you get sick just by the nature of eating different things, being more adventurous with what you do. And you just, that's part of the travel experience, right? Travel is like a marriage.
And then do you think your body actually adapts to it?
Your body adapts to it, yeah. Your body will... as long as you don't get shipped home, it's not that bad of a thing. Your body learns and it gets stronger out of it. I would recommend certain medications that people should always travel with if they are willing to be more adventurous with their food, and definitely don't go without certain vaccinations. Otherwise, sometimes the misery is just not worth it. A little bit is part of the travel experience. Nobody wants a travel story, by the way, where they go to a country and they come back and say everything was fine. Everything was great. Everything went according to plan. Nothing mm-hmm. went wrong. No one's going to care about that. And you're not going to be even like grateful for it. You're going to be just happy that you left. But then like you have no stories, right? Stories are an illustration, fiction We love fiction because it's an illustration of change. Stories for ourselves is illustrate some kind of change, but you're not going to change unless you come from someplace that needs change and it needs growth, right? And for me to go out there to learn about, you know, what my limits are physically, emotionally, mentally, what I can handle when being sick is important, impactful to me of what I'm capable of. I think just even most recently, even like not food related, but I was in Tibet last year and altitude sickness is really real. Like it feels like the worst hangover of your life and out of breath. And you could die from it if you don't take care of yourself and overexert yourself from flash pulmonary edema, cerebral edema, or the water in your lungs or your brain, or the only cure is to descend, right? And luckily it was pretty bad, but it wasn't that bad. And I took it easy, but just knowing what I, like, that was, just being able to say I survived that and knowing what my limits are, I'm more aware of what I can take on in the future.
All I can imagine is how awesome your microbiome would be if we analyzed it.
Oh my God, I have like 20 different like vaccination viruses and attenuated viruses and inactivated stuff in my body right now from all the shots I've had. My flora, my gut flora is probably just like the United Nations.
Yeah, that's awesome. So where can people find you?
MonsoonDiaries.com is my website. Monsoon, like the force of nature that we are when we travel. M-O-N-S-O-O-N, diaries, like the motorcycle diaries. All one word. But the best way to reach me is on Facebook. I respond the fastest to that. Facebook.com/MonsoonDiaries. It's pretty simple. If you want to reach me personally, like a personal account, Calvin D. Sun is my page. Just my first name and middle initial D for damn, Sun, S-U-N. Sorry, I had to do that.
That's cool.
And then from there, you just work your way forward. I will respond to everything. I read everything. And I'm as disciplined as I am blogging every day. I am also disciplined in responding to everything that is reasonable. If you spam me, I will not respond to that.
Right. And I just want to read one more thing from your graduation speech at SUNY Downstate, where you went to medical school. And I'm kind of curious to hear your thoughts on what you're thinking when you wrote it. Sure. But you wrote, "I also hope we will feel it incumbent upon us to treat even the non-biological issues of the world, identifying ourselves not only as doctors after today, but also as activists, peacemakers, statesmen, ambassadors, innovators, philosophers, or engineers. And above all, that we become artists, always pushing the limits and our dreams of what medicine can accomplish." So where was your mind at when you were writing that?
I gave my graduation speech, I was going through this existential meaning crisis where I felt like I didn't belong, right? It was the ultimate imposter syndrome. I'll explain that in a way that I guess a lot of people can relate to, especially in medicine, where when you start off in medical school, anything that you felt like got into, most of us, if not all of us, have some moment in time where we feel like we're imposters. Like we got in through the back door, that we don't belong there, that everyone else deserves getting in except for us, that we took somebody else's spot that deserved it more than we did. And then one of these days, someone's going to find us out and then kick us out, right? And I felt like that in medical school. And I know that everyone else felt that way too. But I was a struggling medical student. I did not do well in school. I was not the best test taker. I knew the material. I just did not take tests. And that's something that's, you know, been like that since the dawn of time. Since I was born, I was just never good at taking standardized exams, and my scores weren't great. There was a time where I almost thought I was going to fail out. There was a time I had to conditional, like remediate a couple courses, which then puts me out of the running for like most residencies, right? To have that conditional remediation on your transcript. I was the bottom 50% of my class, and there was a point where I just felt like. And I think I had to remediate right before I was supposed to take my step one. So if I didn't pass the remediation, then I was not supposed to take step one because I would have to repeat the year. And all that happened. And luckily, I just got by the skin of my teeth, mm-hmm. right? Just barely pushing over the 68 mark, rounding me up so I can pass and just barely passing the remediation so I could take step one, which I ended up getting a really bad score. And then they told me I could make it up by taking step two and then getting even a worse score, like 1 point above passing. Wow. It would be actually failing right now. They actually increased the threshold for passing and I would have failed. But I passed at the time. And I was just like, when I applied to residency, people were just like, nope, you're not going to get it, the residency that you want. And you know, luckily I had some people who supported me and believed in my leadership, like in extracurriculars, to support me through to get the interview. And then me being genuine and honest, I'm lucky to have gotten into one of the best residencies in emergency medicine in the country. And just even residency also going by, right? And in the graduation speech, I was thinking that, wow, I don't belong here. And I'm speaking on behalf of my class, a class of people who are just way smarter than I am, who want medicine, wanted medicine, I think, more than I did, who really buckled down and made this their life. Whereas for me, I did other things. I was a public speaker. I did activism. I was in ICASU, and I was traveling and doing the Monsoon Diaries. And here I am being selected to give the graduation speech as president of my class, and realizing that I'm only – and I had to, like, reassure myself, right? That's the great thing about traveling alone, that you also learn how to talk to yourself and become your best friend. I had to become my own best friend because nobody else would be able to understand. In fact, if I talked to my fellow med students, they would be like, yeah, you were distracted a lot. Like, we never understood, like, you as a human being, like, or as a med student. I could only understand myself, and I was trying to tell myself, like, what any best friend would say. You belong here. You deserve this, mm-hmm. right? You're only here for certain reasons, and they chose you for a reason. You got reelected twice to serve as president of class, to become the permanent president, to give this speech. They knew that you were going to do this at a time where you were presenting yourself as anything but a typical medical student. And I had to tell that over and over and over again. I realized that I belonged there not and deserved it, not because I studied really hard or I spent countless hours with books all the time, but I was a human being and I was doing the things that made me feel human, right? To be a good doctor, you have to be a good person first. It's not the other way around. You can't learn to be a good doctor first and then try to be a good person afterwards. You know, it's something where a good person, what does it mean to be a good person, to be a human being, to have, to accept and to embrace all the complexities and dichotomies and the shades, that everything that we just talked about in the past hour, that makes you a unique human being, the person that brings something, a life experience to the table when you approach a patient and be able to relate to them in whatever it means that it is, no matter where they come from or whatever language they speak or whatever culture they're from. There's something in your life experience, in your diverse experience, if you've hopefully had a life full of diverse experiences, that you can relate to them and connect with them and be there for them in the worst times of their lives. And for me to give that speech in that moment, to be able to say that this is what brought me here, by the skin of my teeth, I'm standing here giving the graduation speech as a doctor now, to tell everyone to be incumbent upon them to try to be someone more than just a doctor, to right. be a human being, to do all those other things that they can have access to now with the MD, and to become the best person they can be, rather than just the best doctor they could be. And this carried me forward through residency, where I had similar challenges during residency, where I'm now the director of wellness, my fourth year, the first wellness position that created a fifth chief position for the year after. That was ironic that I was given this role, given how tough residency can be for all of us, including myself. Yeah. But I owe that distinction, whether it's class president, giving the graduating speech, and director of resident wellness, I owe that to me sticking to what I know best and what I believe in, rather than doing what other people tell me to do and how to do it. Because I'm a person first, and I'd rather stick to my, you know, what I know as a human being and what it means to be Calvin's son, rather than trying to live other people's lives and what they expect of me because of what they perceive me. Because I'd rather do that and, you know, not sacrifice my values than to pretend to be somebody else and be a doctor who doesn't know himself. So yeah, I'm glad you asked that.
Yeah, and I think it's like the perfect way to end this. So thanks very much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me, Bassam. This has been fun and a pleasure.
Mark Twain, the famous 19th century American writer, once said, 20 years from now, you'll be more disappointed by the things you didn't do than by the things you did do. So throw off the bowlines, sail away from the safe harbor, and catch the trade winds in your sails. So there you have it, listeners. You have no excuse not to travel. Pick a destination, plan ahead, and just go.
For more information about Dr. Hustle, to view today's show notes, or to contact Bassam, visit drhustle.com. If you want others to know about this podcast, please write a review at the podcast store and please link to us on social media at Dr_Hustle on Twitter and at Dr.Hustle on Instagram. This podcast is produced by Bassam Zahid, whose other work can be found at BassamZahid.com. Thanks for listening.